Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Tomorrow, faculty at Sac State will be protesting stalled negotiations between the California State University system and the California Faculty Association, which represents close to 30,000 lecturers and professors statewide. At issue is money. While both sides have already agreed on a number of demands, salary and how quickly raises can be implemented is one of the primary conversations. Faculty argue raises are long overdue and needed now. The CSU system says that the amount of money and timing of these raises are too much, too soon, and could force a number of other problems. The planned one-day strikes start Monday, and it started on the CSU campus in Pomona in Southern California, yesterday at San Francisco State, today at Cal State Los Angeles, and tomorrow here in Sacramento. Joining us to discuss the root issues behind the strike is Ashley A. Smith, a higher education reporter with EdSource. And in a moment, we'll also be joined by CAP Radio reporter Janelle Salonga with a closer look at what's expected at Sac State tomorrow. Hey, Ashley, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with some background and really the key players that are involved in this. We have the CSU system, which consists of 23 campuses across the state, as well as the California Faculty Association. Can you tell us a little bit more about the CFA, who it represents, and what it advocates for?
Sure. So the CFA represents about 29,000 professors and lecturers across the 23 campuses. And they really have been fighting to address wage increases and also promote a healthier working environment for faculty and staff and for students across the campuses.
Given that there are already 23 campuses across the state, why are the four-day-long strike, the one-day strikes happening this week, only happening across four campuses?
Well, CFA chose these four campuses because they felt that they would have the largest impact to the system. These campuses, for example, Pomona has had a real issue with counselors, the ratio of counselors to students. And that is one of the issues that CFA has been bargaining and negotiating with the CSU about. They want to see more counselors on campuses to lower those ratios and provide more support for students. And so that's one reason why Pomona was selected. But they specifically chose these campuses because they felt that they would have a significant impact on the system.
How long have these negotiations been going on?
Well, since really last year, CFA has complained and gone to the Board of Trustees multiple times about improving wages and salary and working conditions. And really this spring, they started to hint that strikes could happen because it seemed to be show early on that those discussions weren't going anywhere. Mm.
What has the California Faculty Association and the CSU system, what have they already agreed to?
So they've already agreed to improving some of the working conditions. There has been some agreement on leave and such, but really the biggest disagreement, the fundamental disagreement is really around pay. And at the heart of this disagreement is that they do not see eye to eye on just how the financial situation for CSU looks.
The CFA is one of multiple collective bargaining groups within the CSU system, and Cal State, the university or the system at large, has already reached similar deals with other unions. Can you tell us which unions and what they've settled on? I know here at Sac State, the Teamsters, you know, held some demonstrations not too long ago.
Yeah, well, and we just should add that the Teamsters, who represent the skilled trade union, they are actually striking in solidarity with CFA this week. There's about 1,100 workers that they represent. And so that group is also Teamsters Local 2010. That group is also still waiting for an agreement as well. But CSU did reach an agreement with some of its other employee groups, for example, the CSU Employees Union, which represents about 15,000 employees in support positions, administrative positions. There is the UAW Local 4123. They represent the academic student employees, so graduate and teaching assistants. And then also the statewide University Police Association, which represents the police officers and sergeants in the university police departments. All of those unions that CSU has reached an agreement with, they all agree to about a 5% bump in salary. And so those agreements are set right now. And right now what's left out there is the Skilled Trades Union and the Faculty Association.
So what does the Faculty Association want? How far apart are they when it comes to salary?
Well, the faculty want a 12% general salary increase this year. CSU has said that that could cost them about $318 million more dollars a year. And CSU is offering 5% increases over the next 3 years, so for a total of 15%. So as you can see, there is a bit of a discrepancy between what each group wants. There was this third-party independent fact finder that recommended a 7% one-time increase this year, which is less, obviously, than what the faculty want, but somewhat in the middle of what the chancellor's office is proposing, but still less than what the chancellor's office is proposing. And so there so far does not seem to be any movement. The faculty have been solid and united on 12% for quite some time.
Yeah, and that seems pretty far apart. I mean, given that there's other collective bargaining groups that were negotiating, some demonstrating as well, you know, this follows obviously like more than 3 years since the start of the pandemic. And we know for educators, they shouldered a brunt of those challenges. There's understandable burnout. I mean, what role has that played in really like a group of collective bargaining groups, you know, having difficult or at times stalled negotiations with the Cal State system?
Well, I think that, I mean, we all can see that the cost of living in California is significantly higher than in other places, and that, you know, prices have been rising. People are struggling. And there was a faculty salary study that came out last year that was highly criticized by the faculty. They were not fans of the salary study, but the study did find that in certain areas of the state, for example, in San Francisco, faculty are paid below market rate. And it could be incredibly difficult for faculty to essentially live, to pay their bills. And that's what I've heard from, you know, professors and from lecturers who talk about, you know, how they've been able to continue their work. It has been a struggle for them. You know, if we want to talk about real numbers, I mean, the average for all CSU professors and lecturers is about $82,000 across the system. And, you know, at the base level, the union essentially wants to increase, you know, at a starting about $54,000 just to $64,000. So, you know, depending on where you live in California, that may not be enough money to support a family or to pay student loans or to buy groceries and or afford rent and a mortgage. So that's how, you know, the faculty have been living for, you know, past few years.
You know, when it comes to leadership within the Cal State system, I mean, we have a new chancellor, Mildred Garcia, and these negotiations predated, you know, Millie Garcia becoming the chancellor of the CSU system. What does the chancellor and just the system say about, you know, these pay increases, wanting, you know, I think you say upwards of like a 12% salary increase for faculty?
Well, the chancellor's office says that they can't afford it. That they don't have the money for it. And, you know, that financial sustainability study that CSU released earlier this year that promoted the system-wide tuition increase that the board passed. One way that they said they would be able to help pay these salaries and benefits would be increasing tuition. But even with the tuition increase, the system has said that individual campuses are still going to have to make cuts, that if they increase everyone 5% across the board, they are still going to be short. And we know that San Francisco State, for example, that they have already talked about cutting about 100 positions in order to make budget for next year. So right now they're saying that even with the 5% bump in revenue from the state, from Governor Newsom, that even with the tuition increase, they are still going to be short. Now, the faculty obviously disagree with that. They feel that CSU has plenty of money in its coffers and its reserves to cover any type of salary increase. But CSU disagrees with that. They feel that those monies, the reserves, cannot be used for something like salaries and benefits, that those are emergency dollars for natural disasters and recessions and only one time use. So again, it goes back to the heart of this. This is very a disagreement just about the base of Cal State's funding and what is there and what isn't.
Yeah, and it seems like there's more negotiations to continue even beyond these one day strikes. Ashley, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Vicki.
Ashley A. Smith is a higher education reporter for EdSource. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the faculty strikes at four Cal State campuses this week, including Sacramento State, which is planned for tomorrow. We're joined by CAP Radio reporter Janelle Salonga now. Hey, Janelle.
Hey, Vicki. Thanks for having me on again.
So you've been focusing on ongoing negotiations, particularly when it comes to Sac State. There's a lot to dig into, but let's just start with the mood on campus. What does it look and feel like?
Yeah, so faculty have been tabling about the strike over the past few weeks at the Library Quad. You know, they've been handing out flyers. They've been talking to students. They've been, when I went on Monday morning, someone had, you know, a megaphone and was telling students there's a strike on Thursday. And so, you know, the California Faculty Association, Sac State chapter, has also, you know, been pretty active in having events like picket walkthroughs and weekly solidarity rallies in previous months, just kind of leading up to the strike and talking about the state of negotiations. And
so there's been obviously like a momentum building up and trying to build awareness about what's going to take place tomorrow. Do you have a sense of what the general turnout could look like tomorrow?
Yeah. And so I guess just for context, you know, there are just under 1900 full and part time faculty members at Sacramento State. And so I've heard that, you know, hundreds of professors are expected to walk out and withhold their labor tomorrow, according to those who have RSVP'd. And of course, you know, not everyone is going to RSVP. Not everyone may participate. Not everyone may even go to the picket line, but they may still be withholding their labor. And that also, you know, that number hundreds is vague and doesn't account for faculty who may be coming to stand in solidarity, representing, you know, other campuses throughout the CSU system. And so when I spoke with Kathy Jamison, who's the vice president for Sac State's California Faculty Association chapter, she told me that she actually expects the largest turnout of all these one-day strikes tomorrow.
Wow, the largest one. And this is the last one of the week, the fourth one out of the Cal State campuses that are participating. You know, where are the staging points if people are kind of logistically planning their day, you know, tomorrow? What should they plan for?
Right. So the main pickets will be at the campus entrances. Picketers will, you know, be carrying signs and there will be, you know, in some cases, music. I've heard from professors that there will be son jarocho music, marching akin to kind of like a marching band, and a DJ will be present. That's all to kind of keep up the energy for the strike. So, you know, if you hear lots of noise, you're probably nearing a picket line. And some faculty members may even be bringing their children, and picket lines will include things like craft tables for kids to make their own signs as an additional feature.
You mentioned that the vice president of Sac State's CFA chapter, Kathy Jamison, said that she's expecting tomorrow to be the largest of all the one-day strikes this week. I mean, what did she tell you when it comes to Sacramento State's faculty, their overall asks and their overall message?
Right. And so, you know, of course, while as you were speaking with Ashley, you know, you all were talking about salary. Of course, that's a huge part of what faculty are pushing for. But as Ashley said, you know, faculty are also asking for things that will foster a healthy working environment, like paid parental leave, lactation rooms, gender neutral bathrooms. And Jamison said that due to CFA's mission, every proposal the bargaining team puts forward is checked to make sure it's anti-racist and works towards social justice.
We are always fighting for those things that not only make us able to pay the bills, but make us able to show up with dignity, feeling safe, feeling respected and supported in the work that we will do, right? We live in a moment where we are always, if we're doing our jobs right, talking about difficult issues and helping students learn how to make those arguments and understand things happening in the world. We need to be protected when we do those things. Of course it's about more than salary. The work is about more than the paycheck, but the paycheck matters.
And she also went on to link, you know, faculty working conditions like salary to student well-being and emphasized that faculty and student success are connected. They're linked together.
We lose faculty all the time because they can't afford to live here. They can't afford to stay on their measly pay. And students are unable to get all the classes in a timely fashion. So we're clearly in this together. We've known this for a long time. And students and faculty know that we are stronger together. And this management messaging about faculty taking money away from things that would otherwise be able to serve students is just, it's not even a message that gets any traction. Students are too smart for that.
Okay, so we just heard from the Faculty Association. On the Sac State side, what is the university saying about the strike plan for tomorrow?
Yeah, so the university actually prepared a frequently asked questions page for students about the strike and says it's, you know, been preparing for the eventuality of a work stoppage ever, you know, even before one was formally announced on the Sac State campus. And so on that note, you know, the university is saying that its top priorities continue to be student success, the ability for students to complete their semester courses, and providing a quote unquote safe and welcoming campus environment for students and everyone.
Okay, so when it comes to student success and continuing education, students might be wondering how will the strike impact them? I mean, what about grades, tests, and courses? I mean, the semester is almost over.
Yeah, so instructors, you know, a lot of instructors have been telling students they'll be withholding their labor, so there won't be class or office hours or anything like that on Thursday. But, you know, each faculty member kind of has their individual policies for how to handle that. And the university is telling students to continue to go to classes if they haven't received any confirmation from faculty about any information about their classes on Thursday.
Did you get a better idea of why this is a planned one-day strike and not a longer strike?
Yeah, so I mean, to be fair, it is, you know, technically a four-day strike with one-day events at each campus. But I actually spoke with an associate professor at Sac State, Maya Dosh, who, you know, had more to say about that. So here's what they had to say.
You know, we are here for our students, and we start with one-day strikes because we don't want to hurt our students. We want to make sure that their instruction continues and it gives a chance for management to come back to the table with us. And then if they don't, we can move on to something more.
Yeah, and so there's actually also a contingent of, you know, kind of rank and file faculty across 10 different CSU campuses, including Sac State, SF State, you know, some of the other campuses that were sites for the one-day strikes, you know, that are called Cal State Faculty United, and they're pushing for, you know, the potential of escalated action, more strategic action. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's realistic, or it seems like after this week, there could be more, you know, next year.
Right. Depending on, you know, what happens after these strikes, whether the CSU decides to come back to the bargaining table, you know, whether the CSU is satisfied or CFA is satisfied with CSU rebuttals. It's all kind of up in the air. So, yeah, like I said earlier, we'll just see what happens.
Thank you so much for following up on this and giving us an update, Janelle.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Vicky.
Janelle Salonga is Cap Radio Sacramento Communities reporter, sharing the Sac State perspective. A one-day strike among faculty is planned for tomorrow. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The weather is getting cooler, the days are shorter, and in parts of California, the sky fills with flashes of black, white, and brilliant orange. It is not falling leaves. It is a tradition of nature, the annual winter migrations of the Western monarch butterfly. Over the course of a few months, tens of thousands of these iconic insects will travel thousands of miles to escape the cold at locations up and down the California coast. These overwintering gatherings, they're really stunning to see, and they also play a crucial role in the insects' efforts to breed and ultimately one-way migration. And these efforts will be crucial for the species' continued survival, as their population counts have reached near record lows in recent years. So, where are the best places to see these gatherings, these clusterings, and how can we help ensure that these butterflies endure for future generations for others to enjoy? Joining us to talk more about these insects' marathon journey is Isis Howard, an endangered species conservation biologist for the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit, just starting off, about what the Xerces Society is and what it does.
Yeah, so the Xerces Society is named after a little blue butterfly that went extinct a few decades ago. It was the first butterfly to go extinct to human causes. And so that's our namesake. And our mission is to protect nature through the conservation of invertebrates and their habitat.
How did you become interested and kind of devoting a career to being a conservation biologist?
Yeah, it's kind of a, you know, it's a sweet story. So my parents have 5 acres up in Sonoma County, and I grew up as an only child playing in the creek, in the gardens. They started an organic farm. So I've always had this appreciation of kind of living in sync with our ecosystem. And then I went to Cal Poly, so similar to Davis, ag school, ag focus, environmental focus. And I just fell in love with the butterflies. San Luis Obispo is one of those places where we can see the clustering monarch butterflies at the Pismo Monarch Butterfly Sanctuary. So when I first saw it, fell in love.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how was it taking it in for the first time if someone hasn't been before?
If magic is real, you're going to find it at Monarch Butterfly Sanctuaries.
That is wonderful. And I love the earrings,
too.
Isis is wearing Monarch Butterfly earrings right now. Okay, so let's turn to the star of these current migrations, what we're talking about this morning.
Yeah.
So monarchs are clustering along the California coast right now. Where are they coming from and also why?
Yeah, so the monarch butterflies clustering along the California coast are what we call the Western monarch population. A lot of times people think of monarch butterflies and they think of that incredible migration from Canada down to Mexico. And that is the larger eastern monarch population. So we do have monarchs that are native to North America, but they're kind of divided by these rocky mountains. The western monarchs that we're seeing in our state are coming from places like Washington, Oregon, Nevada, California. And they also cluster not only along the California coast, but also into Baja California, Mexico.
What is it about being along the coast that monarchs like?
Yeah, so monarchs are seeking kind of protected tree groves during this time of year so that they can survive the winter storms, the freezing temperatures, and the rainfall. So they're clustering along the coast because the ocean provides this natural buffer for temperature, so they're not going to freeze. Whereas they breed and mate inland where the milkweed's growing, they're actually spending the winters on the coast so that they can survive these winters.
Yeah, yeah. And that's their food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You need to have milkweed. You know, when learning about the FAQ that you had, you know, on the website, you know, it's just so interesting that it's really a one-way migration and that it's kind of like imprinted in them, like in their DNA to know where to go and where to overwinter and to cluster together.
Yeah, so this is another part of that magic. There's multiple generations of monarch butterflies that contribute to this grand journey. The monarchs are going to be migrating hundreds to thousands of miles each year, and there's multiple generations that span that migration. So these butterflies that are clustering along the coastline of California were you know, birthed in a completely different location inland. And so they've never seen these trees. And yet we see the monarchs return to the same exact grove, sometimes the same trees and the same branches on the trees each year, which is really incredible.
Kind of reminds me of salmon.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it does. Exactly. The natal streams.
Yeah. And they know how to get back to their spawning ground. You
ancestral
know?
Knowledge, something like that.
It's incredible. So when it comes to the Western monarchs that are currently clustering and overwintering in California, how long are they going to be there?
Yeah. So we call this the super generation of monarch butterflies. These butterflies live anywhere from 3 months to 9 months long, whereas when we see butterflies breeding and on the milkweed during the summer and spring, those butterflies are only going to live a couple weeks. So this super generation can live a really long time. They're migrating down from the milkweed breeding areas to the coast, and we often see the overwintering season or the clustering season last from October through February, first week or so of March. But right now is a really special time. So if you've never seen these butterflies clustering along the coast of California, now is the time. November and December marks the peak season to see all these butterflies and this natural phenomenon.
Yeah, we're only a couple of days from the weekend and the holidays are around. So maybe some people are taking, you know, some time off. So where are the best spots for people to see these monarchs?
I'd recommend visiting the Pacific Grove Butterfly Sanctuary in Monterey, the Natural Bridges State Park Butterfly Sanctuary in Santa Cruz, the Pismo Butterfly Sanctuary down in San Luis Obispo. There's also Elwood Mesa down in Santa Barbara.
Wonderful. There's a lot of options.
Yeah. And I also want to mention those are the great places because there's docents who can teach you about monarchs, really publicly accessible and wheelchair friendly trails as well. But if you want to check out the map of all of our hundreds of overwintering sites along the coast, you can go to westernmonarchcount.org and check out our interactive map.
And that count is really important. Last year, we had our environment reporter at Caprito, Manolo Sakaita, explain, you know, the declining populations of monarch butterflies over the decades. I mean, what are their biggest threats and how bad has this decline been?
So it's a little bit of a different story between Western and Eastern monarchs. The Western monarchs that we're seeing here in our state have declined more than 95% since the 80s. We used to see low millions back in the 80s. There'd be so many butterflies clustering on trees that the tree branches would actually droop with the weight of monarch butterflies. And just for reference, monarchs weigh less than a paperclip. So it takes a lot of butterflies to droop a tree branch. And the Eastern population, which is larger, that's the Canada to Mexico migration, those have declined by about 70 to 80%. So we're seeing declines in monarchs across the board in North America, and the primary factors that have led to this drop in Western monarch butterflies include, you know, pesticide use, which includes fungicides, herbicides, and other pesticides, and then also climate change is really contributing. We're seeing more frequent, more intense storms that are damaging habitat. Talking about habitat, we're also seeing a lot of loss of habitat, both the breeding milkweed zones, nectar resources, but also these really protective, critical overwintering groves that support and protect the monarchs during wintertime as well.
And the reason why you're able to give us a percentage is because there's also community scientists. You got to count them, right?
Yes, yes.
And that's a crucial part when it comes to monitoring and kind of keeping an eye on Western monarchs.
I'm so glad you mentioned this because really everyone has a role to play, and it's absolutely astounding how we're able to get these estimates and track the population. Everyday people are able to contribute to community science or citizen science. Whether you're a middle school teacher or a carpenter or a doctor, you can actually volunteer to be trained up and go out to these sites and count butterflies for us as part of the annual Western Monarch Count. It's comprised of two counts. One happens during the Thanksgiving period and the other happens around New Year's. The New Year's count is the one that's coming up later this month, and we'll see how monarchs are faring through the winter storm. So it's a little too late to volunteer this season, but I would recommend checking out Xerces.org, Xerces.org, and check out our community science page for different opportunities to get involved. There's lots of things ranging from spring, summer, fall, and winter. Butterflies, bees, fireflies. Yeah, we'd love to have you join our efforts.
How was the Thanksgiving count? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, so volunteers sign up. We train them both virtually and in the field. And then we send them out to these overwintering sites along the coast. And they bring binoculars and our data sheets. And they're actually counting butterflies up in the trees with binoculars. And so they're giving us their an estimate of the number of butterflies clustering in these groves. Sometimes the groves have, you know, a couple dozen butterflies. Sometimes they have more than 30,000. So I am really grateful for the folks yeah. who are counting 30,000 butterflies in the morning and it's cold. But yeah, it's really, really amazing. And then I tally that data back at Xerces and then we come up with this estimate. And so what we're seeing this year is we're seeing a little bit of a drop from the past couple years. So back in 2018 through 2020, we saw record lows. In 2019, we saw less than 2,000 butterflies clustering along the coast. I mean, that's
From millions
in the 80s. Really, really steep decline. Then the last couple years, we saw this uptick up into 200,000, 300,000. And this year, what we're seeing is not quite those, you know, not quite the low lows of 2019, but also not as high as last year. So the latest, I'm still kind of analyzing the data right now, but we've seen over 100,000, but yet to see if we'll break 200,000.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we've been speaking with Isis Howard from the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation about the annual migration of monarch butterflies, which is going on right now along the California coast. You mentioned this really, really steep decline. Why aren't monarchs under the California Endangered Species Act? Because they're not, correct?
That's correct. So right now, monarchs are a candidate species for the Endangered Species Act, meaning that they're up for a listing decision. Luckily, we do expect monarchs to be listed by fall of next year, which would offer legal protections to help protect their habitat. So hopefully we will see an increase in protections there so that we can, again, protect those overwintering groves, protect the milkweed habitat, and really see some more law and policy supporting our butterflies.
Yeah, and butterflies are just one of these really important pollinators out there. And you talk about the circumstances that have led to their steep declines. I would imagine that extends to other pollinators as well over the same course of time.
It's true. Monarchs are really special pollinators because they represent the plight of the pollinator. So not only do they have this cultural significance, but they're also representing this conservation effort to protect pollinators at large. So our efforts to protect and support monarch butterflies are then leading to protections and support for our other native pollinators, such as our bumblebees and moths and everything like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
If someone thinks, you know, maybe just isn't aware of the importance of a butterfly and thinks like, okay, well, losing a butterfly or a decline in population is unfortunate, but, you know, it's not that big of a deal. You know, these insects obviously play an important role in the environment. Can you talk about the niche that monarchs fill?
Yeah, so monarch butterflies are a pollinator. They're not pollinating as many plants as our native bees are, but they're serving as a pollinator, and also they have this interesting relationship with our native plant, milkweed. And so we think about the way that animals and plants have co-evolved, and there's kind of this ripple effect out, right? So if we take away monarchs, we're taking away all the species that rely on monarch butterflies for food, you know, for pollination and all of that. Our native songbirds rely on our pollinators in their larval stage to support them and their fledglings. So also, if we're getting rid of our pollinators, we're hurting our native songbird population as well. So if you're not a butterfly or a bee person, maybe you're a bird person. And so, yeah, there's that. And, you know, even bears, like black bears are eating moths and caterpillars as well. And so we think about all the different species that are relying on each other. There's just downstream effects of of these species going down.
They're all connected, you know? And you touched upon the cultural significance of a monarch.
Yeah.
You know, talk about how this is, how would you describe the cultural significance of a monarch butterfly?
Yeah, so monarch butterflies really bring together conservation and cultural significance, especially between U.S. and Mexico. So butterflies often symbolize the return of souls, the souls of ancestors, and it coincides with the Day of the Dead, or Dia de los Muertos. And so in October, when the monarchs are starting to return to their groves, that's a similar time to Dia de los Muertos. And so it's believed that each monarch butterfly is a soul of someone who has passed away, and they're returning for a night.
Given that the Xerces Society, obviously, is priority is conservation, especially it's named after a butterfly that has gone extinct. Mm-hmm. What is the call to action that your nonprofit has when it comes to protecting Western monarch butterflies and kind of just the key steps that we can keep in mind?
Yeah, so there's several ways that people can help monarch butterflies, and I want to reemphasize that everyone has a role to play, whether you're a community member, a farmer, someone in policy and advocacy. There's something for everyone. So a few of the top things that people can do to help monarch butterflies include planting native plants that support butterflies, like native milkweed and other blooming flowers from early spring to winter. Additionally, you can reduce your reliance on pesticides through eliminating their use around your home, school, workplace, or supporting farms that use fewer pesticides, such as farms that say organic or they use IPM practices. And you can advocate for those changes in your community as well. You can also get yourself and others excited about insects, becoming an advocate. A lot of species need our help, not just monarchs. So you can write to your legislators, get support for wildlife bills, stronger regulations for pesticides, etc. And lastly, you can join a community science project to report monarchs and milkweeds across a landscape or count bees. And I really recommend you check those out. You can, again, go to Xerces.org, check out our community science efforts and get involved.
Given that you mentioned that the state is aware that, you know, monarch butterflies, the populations are declining in a very steep fashion, and that it may be put on the Endangered Species Act, you know, when could that happen? Could that happen, like, as early as next year?
Yeah, so we do expect monarchs to be listed on the Endangered Species Act in fall of next year. This has gotten pushed out a little bit over the past couple years. I believe that folks at the California Department of Fish and Wildlife are currently trying to figure out the best ways to protect this species. Because monarchs have this epic migration that spans hundreds of miles, they're utilizing, you know, urban, suburban, rural landscapes. Like, how do we protect the critical habitat for monarch butterflies when it kind of ranges everywhere? So they have a tough job of trying to figure out how to define this so that we can best protect monarchs under law.
You mentioned legal protections. I mean, what are some of those legal protections if someone is listed, a species is listed under the Endangered Species Act?
Sure. So I'll take the overwintering sites as an example. Monarchs are returning to these same groves of trees year after year. So what we might expect to see would be protections around these groves where people may not be able to cut down the trees. There's something controversial happening right now. And, you know, it's all nuanced. But right now in California, we're doing a lot of fuels reduction work for good reason. We want to protect our communities from fire risk. But also, monarchs are clustering on tree species like eucalyptus or Monterey pine and cypress. And so, you know, eucalyptus often gets kind of demonized in the fire fuels reduction work just because it's so flammable. And it's a non-native tree. Unfortunately, monarchs are clustering on this, and we often see eucalyptus in these overwintering groves. And so what these protections would do is maybe say, like, okay, in this certain area that's defined as the overwintering grove, you would not be able to remove these trees, at least without permits and stuff like that. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that just really illustrates that, you know, when it comes to solutions, it's complicated and there's a lot of competing interests when it comes to really important solutions. Finally, if someone goes to one of the overwintering sites along the coast, is there a good time to go?
Yeah, right now is a wonderful time to go see monarch
butterflies. Or time of day.
Oh, yeah. So my favorite time of day is around 9:30 a.m. Monarchs begin to fly when temperatures exceed 55 degrees. And so if you want to see that epic burst of clusters where monarchs start to, you know, their wings start to ripple and then you see them cascade out of their cluster into flight into the sky, I'd recommend going around 9:30 or right when it starts to warm up.
Yes, and bring a jacket. Yes. Isis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Isis Howard is an endangered species conservation biologist with the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And we've been talking about the winter migration of monarch butterflies, which is taking place over the next few months across California. And now is the best time to see them at overwintering sites along the coast. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 58 years ago, on December 3rd, the Beatles released Rubber Soul. The 1965 album includes legendary hits like Drive My Car, In My Life, Nowhere Man, Michelle, and Norwegian Wood. If hearing those song titles has you thinking, I gotta listen to that album again, you are in luck if you want to take it in live. A Sacramento band named the Green Grass Snakes will be performing the album in full tomorrow night at the Davis Odd Fellows. The show is free, and all donations go to the musicians. Joining us now is the band's drummer, Larry Schiavone, and Julie Rogley with the Davis Odd Fellows, which puts on the monthly series of live music for the public to enjoy. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Vicky.
Okay, Larry, I want to start off with you. The hardest question, where did the name Green Grass Snakes come from?
I believe our one of our singers, Matt Lankara, I believe one of his children came up with that name, and it stuck.
Yeah, you know? It's a good one. I like it. How'd you all get together and start this?
Well, that's a good question. Matt Lankara, Mark Dokaira, they basically childhood friends, grew up playing this music. And I call those guys the little brothers because they're a little bit younger than the rest of us in the band. But, it boils down to music we love with people we love. And one of my very dear good friends is Larry Tagg, a great bass player. He's played, you know, with huge... Over
Big
the
X.
years, Bourgeois yeah. Tag had hits on the radio, all that stuff. Anyway, we became very good friends over the years, and he came to me and he said, Larry, he goes, you're the perfect guy for this band. You know, we grew up listening to this music.
Yeah, and the rest is history.
And the rest is history. And I got to mention Dave Van Dusen. He's been a keyboard player in the band that I played with for the last 25 years, and so it was just kind of a natural fit, you know, all loving the music together. And, you know, it's exciting.
I love that the mission of, you know, on the band's website is really just to like remind people of great songs from the past. And I obviously the Beatles is a good example of that. When did the Greengrass Snakes start playing, you know, Beatles albums in full?
We started actually doing the album project last March. Last year, March, we did Abbey Road at the Side Door. I'd like to thank John Green for that. And then... hey, what's next? Let's do it again. And obviously, with the anniversary coming up of Rubber Soul, that was an obvious choice. So, you know, it was a great undertaking and a lot of fun to do that music, perform that music.
Yeah, we do have a listen of when you all played a part of Abbey Road. So let's listen to a part of Come Together.
Georgian football, he got monkey finger, he shoot Coca-Cola, he said, I know
And that's what people can take in tomorrow, Julie. That brings me to you. They're going to be performing Rubber Soul tomorrow night at Davis Odd Fellows. For those unfamiliar, tell us about this organization.
Well, the Odd Fellows have been around in the U.S. since the early 1800s, and the Davis Odd Fellows have been around in Davis since 1870, which is before Davis was Davis, and it's only a few years after the Civil War. And I'm very proud to say the Davis Odd Fellows is absolutely the largest, has the largest membership in the U.S. and probably the largest membership in the world. We have probably over 350 members. It's an all-volunteer organization, and we do a lot of really great civic work. We raise a lot of funds for local nonprofits, and we have a lot of fun doing it.
How did you get involved?
There are some really good friends of ours, the Rosenbergs, who are involved in a lot of community things in Yolo County. And they had just, this is about, 14, 15 years ago, the hall was in great disrepair. They put about $750,000 into upgrading and beautifying the hall. And my husband is a musician, and I'm a great music lover. And they enticed us by saying, we got a beautiful upper hall with a stage. Come down and start putting music on at the hall. So we've been doing that for about 15 years. We've had, we started in 2009. So we've been putting on 9 shows a month for Thursday Live and some various other shows during the year.
That's wonderful. Oh, it's more fantastic. Than a decade now and counting.
Yeah.
So explain Thursday Live, because it's open to the community. It happens once a month for 9 months out of the year. And the Greengrass Snakes are going to be doing December tomorrow.
Yeah. Right. It started as a dream for my husband, Kurt, and myself. It was a great way for people to get to know the Odd Fellows Hall. It was this building right downtown that people walked by and didn't give it a second thought. So we decided to start putting these shows on and not charging. And that we knew would get people in. They start at 7:30 in the evening, which is early. They end usually at about 9:30, and they're free. It's donation only. We don't require any minimum donation, and we thought this would be a great way to bring the community into the hall. And in the beginning, it was a struggle. We were having to borrow sound equipment from Watermelon Music, which was downtown at the time. We had nothing. But through the years, it's become a major community event. We've been able to buy sound equipment. Kurt, my husband, does the sound every month. And people have gotten to know the Odd Fellows through that, and of course, many, many other activities really well. And we decided that we would keep this donation only way of doing things, because we found that the people that come are incredibly generous. And we feel like we get a bigger crowd and a better mm-hmm. crowd every month by keeping it that way. So, and the bands have been very happy. So,
yeah, where does this fit into the overall mission of the Davis Odd Fellows doing this? Because it's part of community service and bringing people together.
It is. So the Odd Fellows have a motto of visiting the sick, relieving the distressed, educating the orphan, burying the dead, friendship, love, and truth. So we have a lot. Our Odd Fellow Lodge works on the committee way of doing things, and we have probably over 80 committees. Many of our committees are fundraising committees that put money back into the community, into other nonprofits. Others, like the music committee, are just a way of getting people to know what we do. I make announcements every month before the concert starts, just to tell people what's going on and what we do and where they are, that this is the Odd Fellows building. And if you want to join. We welcome everybody. What we say is we are an organization that says yes. So if you join us and you have an idea, we say, there you go. That's a great idea. Go forth and do it. Start a committee, whatever it is. So it's a way to get people into the lodge for a very fun event, but to get the word out on what we do. Yeah. And we have a passion for music. So it's all volunteers. It's not just Kurt and I are more the face of it, but there's a lot of hard work that goes behind Thursday Live and everything else we do.
And then tomorrow, Larry and the band, the Greengrass Snakes, is going to be playing. What keeps you doing it time and time again? You know, I imagine it must feel so good, you know, bringing a smile to people's faces, remembering these like iconic hit songs over the decades and generations.
Yeah, you know, we, well, I can speak for myself, is I can see the effect on the audience that the music has, and then we take in that energy too.
It's an exchange.
It's an exchange, mm-hmm. It's like a, I don't know. It's like this fusion of energy. It's electricity, and I don't know how to describe it. It's just it's a thrill, and to add on top of that, I noticed the last show that we did something like this. Some of my friends I grew up with listening to this music. And it was powerful.
Yeah.
It was really good.
It's very special. Larry and Julie, thanks for stopping by.
Oh, thank you very much, Vicky.
It's going to be a lot of fun tomorrow.
Yeah, come on out, 7:30.
Larry Schiavone is the drummer of the Sacramento band, the Greengrass Snakes, and Julie Rogley is with the Davis Odd Fellows, which puts on the monthly series of live music for the public to enjoy. The Greengrass Snakes will be performing the Beatles' Rubber Soul album in full tomorrow night at 7 p.m. It is free, and all donations go to the musicians. That is it for Insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.